Luke Roman, founder and president of FFTT, Forest for the Trees. Welcome to the Competent Investor. Thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. It's great to be here.
So, Luke, I always look forward to these conversations. I try to be as respectful as I can of your time, even though I wish I could talk to you damn near every week here, but I know you're a busy guy. So I'd like to kind of start by getting a, let's say, a sense of what you see the consequences, let's say, of the US and China kind of in some ways having a race for critical minerals, critical infrastructure, whether that be AI infrastructure. Maybe let's start with the rare earth move by China. On the other side of that, we see the US kind of trying to reindustrialize and reinvigorate their mining sector. Do you see this as a possible move toward, to use your word that you're so fond of, the a signpost of possibly, a road to maybe more active engagement between the two nations?
I'm hopeful that it is. I'm, depending on the day, I'm more or less optimistic that that's the case. I think we have reached, I think we have crossed a Rubicon of sorts. From the standpoint of the US policymakers and what I would call sort of traditional elites, recognizing that the status quo system has gone too far, the pendulum has swung too far, which is to say, on current course and track, what's going to end up happening is China will make everything for the US military, they will make everything for all US retailers, and the US economy. Will essentially be reduced to, some high-end tech and some bankers sort of recycling. We will be sort of a financial hub, and then a whole bunch of people on universal basic income or something. Like that's it is, and I think they recognize the unsustainability and the unattractiveness. For that, for a number of different reasons. Number one, we won't be able to service our debt very effectively without printing money. Number two, there's political stability issues that we're already starting to see manifest increasingly intensely, unfortunately. So I think the negotiation between both seems to be both sides trying to extricate themselves from something that's very tricky to extricate themselves from, which is to say, China has essentially backed the treasury market. They've essentially backed the dollar, their factory base. And we're trying to separate from that in some way, shape, or form without any of the negative impacts. We're trying to find the Goldilocks level of separation. The challenge is that in a vacuum, I'm not sure there's a Goldilocks level of separation. With US debt to GDP this high and deficits this high, I'm almost sure that there is no Goldilocks level of separation. It's not a dial, it's an on switch or an off switch. And if we're going to move away from China, there needs to be something done with the debt. You basically have to devalue the debt massively before you do that to avoid a crisis.
So now bringing in, let's say, the way you've recently framed it, in one of your letters, China building high-end semiconductor supply versus, let's say, the US rebuilding its industrial base, who do you think wins that race?
I think China wins that race. And the reason I think that is empirically, we saw China come out in China 2025 back in 2015 with their China 2025 plan. And at the time, sort of everybody in the traditional elites laughed at it. maybe save one or two. Nobody's laughing anymore. Nobody's laughing anymore. And there are still some really critical things that they have not been able to figure out, particularly along the lines of certain high-end semiconductor cap equipment, certain high-end AI chips, if you will. But that's exactly what they said about China 2025 and 2015. They'll never figure this stuff out. They'll never build a jet. They'll never. And now they're going, hey, slow down. You're building too much of the stuff we said 8 years ago you could never build. And so, in my experience, I have sort of a unique lens relative to a lot of other folks in Western finance, in that we were one of the early. My region of the world in the U.S. Rust Belt was one of the early sort of victims, I guess, if you will, of the China shock. I was on stage at a conference in 2021. I said, listen, there's a lot of people in this audience who think China can't win. Let me assure you, they can if we keep doing what we're doing. And I said, I know that because I witnessed it for the last 20 years in the U.S. Rust Belt. And there were a lot of snickers in the audience at the time, a lot of laughs at the time. Nobody's laughing anymore. In contrast, I look at what's happening in the US and I say, in that letter, I highlighted, okay, we've got, the Francis Scott Key Bridge fell almost 2 years ago in Baltimore. We've barely done anything yet. They're talking about maybe they will have it up by October of 2028. Let's see. That's what Maryland says. So, building a bridge is absolutely, especially one that big and that high, is absolutely an engineering marvel. It's also an engineering marvel that humans have been doing for at least 100 years. And then I contrast with when bridges have fallen in China or new bridges have been built in China, and I see how much faster they're built than 5 years. And it's going to take us 5 years to build something that is, relatively straightforward, right? There is a very strong human knowledge base of how to do exactly that. Now, challenges in the US, a lot of the steel, industrial, engineering has been hollowed out to a significant extent. So we're in a race against sort of this generation of Americans who are going to age out in the next 5, 8, 10 years, that we're sort of building all this stuff and before we started really financializing everything 40 years ago. So if I had to bet who's gonna sort of get to it first, with the race really being China getting to higher end semiconductors and semi cap equipment versus the US rebuilding the quorum of a rare earth supply chain, I think you have to bet on China based on empirical, people say, well, oh, we did it in the 40s. Sure. And nobody ever, when the next time you hear people say that, because you're seeing everybody say that, well, we did it in the 40s. We just need to go to a wartime footing. We just need to have a Manhattan Project. We did it then, only took us 4 years then. 1940, US unemployment was 15 to 17%. We were 11 years into a Great Depression. You had armies of skilled tradespeople, tradesmen, practically speaking, begging to work. Don't have that now. In 1940, when we went to a wartime footing in 40, or really early 42, the US ran 27% of GDP fiscal deficits. 27%. That would be an $8.5 trillion deficit now. In 1942, when we went to a wartime footing to do what we did, the Fed bought it all. The Fed balance sheet went up 10x in 3 years. Not only that, but it was 90% plus T-bills that they were buying, capped at 3/8%, 3/8 of 1%. That is essentially straight money printing. How did they, again, that
Full-on yield
this
curve
is
control.
a full-on yield curve control. It would, I cannot tell you how inflationary $8.5 trillion financed in T-bill markets at 3/8 of a percent would be. Holy cow. How did they control inflation? Well, They controlled goods. They rationed goods in a very strict manner, which in a two-thirds GDP consumer economy like the U.S. would be catastrophic for the period of time until you sort of actually got a critical mass of an industrial base. And very importantly for U.S. elites, they raised marginal tax. The highest marginal tax bracket in the United States was 90%, 90%. So, yes, we can absolutely do it in 4 years like we did in the Manhattan, if we are willing to do those things. And oh, by the way, if our trading partners like Korea and Japan and China and EU don't raise their marginal tax rate to 90% when we raise it to 90%, if we were to do what we did during World War II to keep the metaphor going, you're gonna have massive capital flight. Massive capital flight. And so we would have to put in draconian capital controls. But the dollar is the global reserve currency. You don't get to put in draconian capital controls without losing dollar reserve status. It would be very good
Right.
for gold. Okay. And even if we use like a more let's use a less extreme, a less hyperbolic example. Let's use U.S. shale, right? I think it's a very apropos metaphor, right? We need rare earths. We need to redevelop a supply chain. We needed to get away from Middle East oil. Great. How did that happen? Well, in 2000, 1999, oil was $15 a barrel. By 2008, oil was $150 a barrel. The dollar collapsed 90% from 1/15th of a barrel of oil to 1/150th of a barrel of oil in 8 years. And then, when combined with technology, when combined with Fed QE, when they grew their balance sheet from 800 billion to 4.5 trillion, and another 5 to 8 years after that, the United States had raised its oil production by 8 million barrels a day from 5 or 6 million barrels a day to 13 to 14 million barrels a day with U.S. shale. So from the year 2000, 2001, what that takes 15 years all in, and dollar weakness and Fed balance sheet expansion. And so like there is still this view of hope, copium, optimism. And listen, optimism is a great thing, but optimism in the when you need realism is a good way to get yourself killed. And for investors, what that translates to is, yes, listen, will America get it right? Of course they will. That's what we do. Will it be trial and error? Yes. Can we do what we did in 1940? Yes. Can we do what we did in 1940 in 4 years? No. Can we do what we did in 1940 in 4 years without literally making the bond market collapse and yield curve control probably not just the treasury market, but the MBS market and probably the corporate, probably a big chunk of the $130 trillion global bond market? No, we can't do that. No. And that's what people, there's this level of bargaining around that, they'll get over.
Yeah, it just seems, I mean, there's so much of these trade-offs that need to happen. One of the other things that I'd like to touch on with you is, we've seen the US government take a 10% stake in some companies that they see as critical. Do you see this as a positive for these mining and mineral sectors, or do you see this as maybe a first step towards nationalization?
I think it's a positive, and I think it's a possibly also a first step towards nationalization.
Should have just said yes.
We have ignored the industrial base. The United States economic policy of the last 40 years has essentially been subjugate the middle and working classes. Subjugate the U.S. industrial base in order to support the bond market, support Wall Street, support Washington deficits. And the corollary to that is China wins. China wins in that situation too. We can see that empirically. So we need to do something to reverse that. And I think these are positive first steps. Now, there are the challenge in doing this, in my opinion, is we're not going to be able to out China. We're not structured that way. we don't, we need to sort of do, China with American characteristics. And we need to take a more holistic approach, which is, hey, great, let's make an investment here. Let's put a price floor to support these industries because otherwise we can see the game plan China's running. Great. But that's not the only price floor you need to put in, right? Like if you want engineers, American engineers, in 5 years, 10 years, you need to say, listen, you go into some version of engineering at a United States accredited university, you are going to have your tuition paid for, full scholarship to everyone who goes in, take the debt on upon the receipt of the degree. You will be it will be completely written off by the US government. Who is the creditor on this stuff anyway? And we will also subsidize your first 5, 8, 10 years of earnings so that you will not make less than $120,000 starting, adjusted for today's CPI. And then you need to do the same for skilled trades, welders, etc. And that will create, that's what you need to do. It has to be more of a holistic type of program. We're not seeing that yet. And I think the reason we're not seeing that yet is if I rolled this out to the sort of half of Washington that still thinks it's 1989 or 1992 or 1998, the Robert Rubens and the Larry Summers, sort of wing of Washington, they would lose their minds. They'd lose their minds. Now, they're also losing their minds about getting their asses kicked by China, but they don't make the connection between the reason their policies are the reason we're getting our asses kicked by China now. So that's a bit of, lack of self-awareness, but that's neither here nor there. I think that's what we need to do. And so it needs to be more holistic. Now, the nationalization question. Look, I am not a fan of nationalization, just to be clear. And I'm also a realist. We're losing. People say, we're not losing. Like, the reason we are reacting the way we're reacting is because we're losing. And we're not losing by, like, it's not like we're like, oh gosh, if we don't do something, this is a close game. We are starting to get beaten badly in a number of very critical areas. And that's why they're reacting the way they are. So, as a realist, I go, listen, I'm not a fan of nationalization. And, like, I'm not naive to think that if we keep losing this badly, there might be more nationalization. I think that might be how it goes. And that's something we have to factor in as an investor. We're and oh, by the way, like look around the world. We nationalized Russia's FX reserves, if you will. Europe just nationalized this Nexperia semiconductor company that China owned. There's not going to be less nationalization, I think, going forward.
Do you think a better place to maybe start would be like deregulation and kind of trying to fast track some of the projects that have been on hold for decades?
You could do, yeah, I think you absolutely could. And where are you going to find the labor? Like that to me is the thing we're not talking about as a country nearly enough. Number one, where are you going to find the labor? And B, number one and B, right? It's Monday morning. Number one, where are you going to find the labor? And two, how are you going to pay them? And three, how are you going to contain the bond market when you do that? To me, it's just so fundamental. It's just so fundamental. We sent our jobs and our factories and our industrial processes overseas. We did that really for two reasons. Number one, the regulatory environmental, but that wasn't the real reason. I mean, that was a nice side benefit. The real reason we did it was to lower costs, support the bond market, create a disinflationary impulse and support financialization of this economy. So, if we're going to bring it back, yes, regulatorily take some of those off. Environment's probably not going to like it a whole lot. That's, it's going to be tricky. Because I do like the environment, I like clean air, I like all that benefit of it. And It's strange credulity to think we can offshore and have it be disinflationary or deflationary, and we can bring it back and have it be disinflationary. It's not. Wages are going to go up a ton. Inflation's going to go up a ton. Our supply chains are so like, it's 3 years to get. It's a 3 year lead time to get a turbine, a backup turbine to run some of these data centers. So like, now imagine. I mean, you've been around mining. Like these things are all over the place. Like, hey, let's take their let's take the let's take the environmental restrictions off. Awesome. Where are you going to get a mine? Where are you going to get a turbine? I just,
I was going to say, you've shared with me the example before as well about electrical transformers and the lead time on some of those, right? Like these are
Well,
all
18 to
critical
24 months.
pieces. Exactly. These are all critical pieces to, depending on the operation, obviously, we know that, but that need to be put in place that you can't just snap your fingers and make them appear.
No, because, oh, by the way, hey, let's just get rid of regulatory. Awesome. Now, as it turns out, again, as you know, most of these mines are not like, 15 miles outside of a major metropolitan area where you can just run wire for a little bit and plug it into the wall. Like, there's nothing there, which means you need to run rail lines. You need to run the infrastructure. You need to run the giant sort of electrical stations to sort of boost the power. You need the actual generation capacity. By the way, your boys in the data centers are buying up all the generation capacity for like the next friggin' 5 to 10 years out. So good luck finding that stuff. Now, you know who I think probably has plenty of capacity for this stuff? If you want to do it faster, China.
China.
China has the transformers. They do, but we're not going to buy them. And okay, I'm going to get myself in trouble. Yeah, no, it's so you can see there's this. That's why I say it's important to be a realist, not an optimist, right? From an idea standpoint, awesome. Yes, take the regulations down, do that. But then that's where the hard part starts, right? The hard part, the easy part's pulling off the regs. The hard part is, where are you finding the miners? Where are you finding the turbines? Where are you finding the, how long is it going to take you to run all that wire, all that infrastructure, all that? Oh, by the way, that's out a whole bunch. And by the way, are you going to restrict your data centers who are competing with China as well? Because if you start pulling one from the other, that's exactly what you're going to do. And then you're going to have to explain to all your consumers why electricity prices are up. And then there's the elephant in the room, that we let off, which is, when all of that inflation hits with 120% debt to GDP, the United States Treasury cannot afford rates above 4.7, 4.8%. Treasury market starts to go into a debt death spiral, taking the whole world with it. And that makes the whole. So, like, the elephant in the room is there's this order of operations. You got to anesthetize the bond market. You need to find a bunch of labor. You need to massively expand industrial capacity, but you can't do it on any time horizon that matters in an uninflationary manner without China's help. But you don't want to use China. It's a bit of a pickle.
Well, to add to that pickle, and I don't mean to make this more complicated, but you had an excellent chart as well in one of your latest letters about the price of oil heading for really a paradox. One, that the continuing lower price of oil that will blow up the bond market due to stagflation. And number two, the
You
price
mean the
of
higher price?
oil.
Sorry, higher price of oil, right?
And number two, the higher price of oil that is needed to prevent supply shortfalls that will also blow up the bond market. So, I mean, there's just at some point the rubber is going to hit the road, and being a realist is really important here, right?
I think that's exactly right. And that's been a chart we've been highlighting for clients for well over 2 years now, which is exactly that. Excuse me. The US, you can take you the US's total oil bill, right? So just total barrels per day times price per barrel times 365 days as a percent of GDP. Anytime that number hits 3%, the US starts to go into sort of a stagflationary situation, which is, rates up, higher rates of inflation, pressure on stocks, pressure on the consumer. And with 120% debt to GDP, you know, stagflationary is fatal. In the 70s, 25, 30% debt to GDP, low deficits. It's very suboptimal, but it's not fatal. 120% debt to GDP with 7% of GDP deficits, 3% of GDP oil bill in the United States is fatal. Full stop. You go into a debt death spiral. And that chart, you know, we have one chart that shows that. And that then leads to this paradox, which is shale needs a price of oil to grow production that gets closer and closer to that 3% over time. We're probably not quite there yet, but we're not, you know, you can see it from here. And so you need to keep oil down to prevent that, you know, that fatal policy outcome, but you need to keep oil up to keep shale production growing to avoid a different outcome, no, a different way of getting to the same outcome, which is, you know, US shale production declines. As shale production declines, US oil consumption is very inelastic, right? So you raise price a lot and demand really doesn't fall much. And so if shale production rolls over, US oil imports are going to return back to where they were over time, which means higher oil imports, higher dollar exports, higher dollar exports, weaker dollar, higher inflation. Now you're going to get to your stagflationary outcome a different way. And again, in that bond market, 120% debt to GDP, it's fatal. So, you know, the resolution of the paradox is you got to let gold go. Basically, the gold to oil ratio has to go. And we're seeing that, right? I think we're going to see a lot more of that, but it's very much a paradox. It is, you know, when layered on with everything else we were just discussing, you know, it's a challenge.
It's quite the understatement. So, Luke, is it possible that the gold market is starting to become this escape valve or the one thing that the US can actually use somewhat to its benefit here?
I think it is. I think it is because ultimately, if you're a really high-level policymaker, you're looking at this paradox where higher oil prices break things and lower oil prices break things in very badly. In other words, you know, collapse things. And that's really important because since 1971, since we've been on the petrodollar system, essentially oil has been on the release valve for inflation. And the gold to oil ratio has been relatively stable within that. And the price of gold has been managed by central banks and by the expansion of unallocated paper gold derivatives to basically enforce the petrodollar system, keep a relatively stable gold to oil ratio. This paradox, this dilemma means that now we need to keep oil in a relatively constant area, in which case the release valve to the inflation needs to be gold. And gold is convenient because, as all its detractors are fond of pointing out, it's not used for anything. So if gold goes to 5,000, so what? Gold goes to 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, so what? If anything, it's actually really positive. You know, these same policymakers are busy saying, well, we need China and India to consume a lot more. Well, take gold at 20,000. They'll consume a lot more than the average person owns a lot of gold. The Americans are looking at it going, whew, we need some way to get our debt down because for everything we just discussed, you need to anesthetize the bond market before you try to do these things. Otherwise, you'll create more of a problem than you solve by reshoring, et cetera. Well, Section 10, 2.10 of the Financial Accounting Manual for Federal Reserve Banks says that Bessent can instruct Powell to revalue gold from $42 an ounce, where it's held at a statutory price, to whatever the market price is. So if the market price of gold is $10,000 an ounce, that's going to put $2 trillion into the Treasury General Account, free and clear. You don't need to sell gold. It doesn't have to move. It is simply money creation using gold with no debt offset. It is pure, pure high octane money creation. If it's 20,000, you're going to get closer to $5 trillion of money creation. that you can use to buy down the debt and fund some of this stuff. So it's a kind of a win-win for everybody, everybody but the real value of bonds.
Right. But when we think about what 5 trillion actually buys us, that's it doesn't end up actually really being that much, right? Considering that we're running, deficits of $2+ trillion just on balance per year, right?
No, it's probably needs to be a bigger number. I mean, you could, what it can do is it can buy you some time, right? $5 trillion, you could buy back 20, almost 20% of the treasury market, right? So you're basically gonna, give holders of treasuries 5 trillion. You're gonna take that 5 trillion out of circulation. That's gonna take debt to GDP down, nominally from 120% to 100. You're probably gonna get more juice for your money. Than that, because I think nominal GDP is going to fly. So, but that assumes somebody holds interest rates low, right? Because ultimately, 5 trillion getting injected into the economy, as we saw in 2020, 2021 with COVID stimmies, inflation's probably going to run 10, 20%. And no one's going to hold bonds yielding 4 at with that. So the Fed has to be involved in some way, shape, or form. But if you were able to do that, you're going to get a multiplier effect where nominal GDP grows really fast for a couple of years, and you probably end up with net debt to GDP, 80%, 70%, something like that, which is all of a sudden sustainable and a level that you can then have the Fed revert back to running an independent monetary policy in theory. But I think to your point, or what I think your point, and I tend to agree with it if that's the case, which is you sort of have one shot to do this. And so if you're going to do it, you better not undershoot it. If anything, you want to overshoot it. Because you can always clean it up on the back end with Fed tightness. But if you undershoot it and you fire this bazooka and it turns out to be a pea shooter, you're done. Like you're in trouble. So I think it speaks to sort of allowing gold to rise a lot further, perhaps, than even 20,000, because the higher it goes, the more it sort of rebalances things. I think it ultimately gold becomes the rebalancing mechanism for it's the least worst option, and in some ways it's a pretty good option, but it's definitely the least worst option.
Luke, how do you think the, basically Bitcoin and the stablecoin legislation plays in here? Do you think that creates enough meaningful demand in the treasury market to offset another, again, meaningful piece of that debt?
Maybe. Maybe it's it's tricky, right? So you've got the long end, you have the short end, and the long end has still been being managed by the Fed, right? The Fed has not sold. In fact, they've still been buying 10-year bonds. Their portfolio of 10-year plus treasuries has never gone down in since 2020. It is still going up as we speak, and people say, well, they're just reinvesting it. Like, I don't care. It is what it is. It's going up. The shorter term stuff has been QT'd, it has been shrunk, and there's plenty of demand for that stuff as collateral, et cetera. So I think what the stablecoin dynamic is trying to do is effectively find repressible balance sheet, find somebody who can hold T-bills at low rates, ideally very low rates, and if that can work around, if they can force foreigners around the world to do that, or encourage foreigners to do that around the world, then that would be great. Now, I think it's a very short-term solution, possibly, because ultimately, if it's very successful, what you're talking about doing is wildly inflating those other nations' currencies, which, if they can't buy commodities in their own currency, their currencies are going to collapse, and they're going to turn around, sell dollars, they're going to turn around, sell dollar assets, and we're right back to square one. So I mean, it's literally sort of, they've said, well, we can, pull swap lines from Europe and force them into dollar, into dollar stable coins, because they'll be backed by T-bills and, offshore dollar euro dollars will not be guaranteed, but with swap lines. Great. It's like peeing your pants. You're Canadian, right? Like, dead of winter, you're cold, you pee your pants. Feels great for about 5 minutes. And then 5 minutes later, not so much, right? I'm in Ohio, so like, we understand this metaphor. The people in Florida be like, wait, what's snow? Anyway, that's what this basically is. It's peeing your pants in the middle of a freezing snowstorm to stay warm. Because, yeah, the Europeans probably would flood into stablecoins. And yes, it would buy a bunch of T-bills. And it's also going to create a euro dollar market crisis. And guess what? The US has a net international investment position of negative 85% of GDP, which means the world in total owns $62 trillion gross, $27 trillion net of our assets. And if they find themselves short dollars, guess what they're going to sell? They're going to sell treasuries first because it's the most liquid, and the Fed will create the money to keep them liquid. And then they'll sell stocks. And then as stocks go down, our deficits will go up. And our deficits go up, treasury issuance will go up. And as treasury issuance goes up, as they're selling treasuries, rates will go up in a crisis, just like we saw earlier this year. And we saw in 24, we saw in 23, we saw in 22, we saw in 20. We saw 19. And so that's why I say it's like peeing your pants in a snowstorm to stay warm. Like this sort of, stable. It can fix things for like a moment, but then what? Like then you're right back to like, oh God, I'm cold. And I think it points it right back to the goal of like, hey, we're at the part of the cycle. You're just gonna have to basically devalue all that debt against gold and move on. And then, move on with your strategy from there.
So do you think that the US possibly needs more gold to be able to do this with, or is the, 8,500 tons enough? And I guess inherent in that is this consideration that China very likely holds far more gold than the US does.
No, I think it's what, 8,100 tons? Yeah, it's plenty. It's all a question of price, right? 4,000's enough. It's the question. 1,000's enough. It's just a question of price. And yeah, China probably does hold more. I think, people say, well, China only has 1,800, US has 8,100, and it's like, wait, you're believing the Chinese now? Like, it's usually the people that are like, the Chinese lie about everything. And then you talk about gold. Well, we have more gold. Like, wait. The Chinese lie about everything. You think you're telling you the truth about their 1,800 tons of gold?
Well,
Come on.
I mean, again, there's a perfect chart going. I think it's, what is it, back to 2008, and it's the Shanghai Gold Exchange, basically. And as I understand it, let's make that disclaimer. As I understand it, no gold leaves China, and so all of the gold that came into the Chinese gold exchange equals, I think I read it was 27,000 tons, right?
Yeah, and it's one of these things where, again, U.S. policymakers keep saying the Chinese need to consume more of their own production. Great. Take gold to 30,000 an ounce, 20,000 an ounce. They'll consume a lot more. Well, the Chinese have a balance sheet problem, right? They've got all this real estate, and they do have a balance sheet problem, right? They've got all these condos and these unfinished houses and all this stuff. Their balance sheets are screwed. Yeah. Take gold to 20,000, 30,000. Guess what? Their balance sheets are unscrewed. And oh, by the way, their banks hold gold, not like our banks. Our banks don't really hold gold. They hold a bunch of treasury as their reserves. Chinese have gold reserves up and down the economy. So the point is that if you want to rebalance, reseparate, you want the West wants the Chinese to consume more of its own production. The Chinese want to recap their balance sheets. They want to de-dollarize. The Americans want some way to deleverage their balance sheet. Like you kind of go down the line. Americans need to deleverage their balance sheet. Gold at 20, 30,000 does it. The Americans want the Chinese to consume more. Gold, 20, 30,000 does it. The Chinese need to delever their balance sheets. Gold, 20, 30,000 does it. The Chinese want to de-dollarize, get away from the dollar. Gold, 20, 30,000 does it. Like it is the Nash equilibrium within the existing system. It's at this point, I don't know if we're quite to that point yet, but again, we can see the point from where we stand. Like the alternatives are going to be gold 20, 30,000 or like World War III or complete economic collapse and a 10-year Great Depression in nominal terms. Those are going to be the choices. And so, I think gold, as we're watching, I think it's just starting to sniff this out, which is hilarious because you're seeing so many traders, they're like, it's a bubble. Like, dude, like, it is so far from a bubble, you can't even believe it, but that's okay. So, gold, yeah, I think Bitcoin, does it have a role to play? Absolutely. Could it, is it a harder money? Technically, yes, it is. Because this, if gold goes to 20,000, 30,000, yeah, there's gonna be a lot more mines and supply coming on again, to our prior to point, a 10-year lag, right? We're having a hard time building electrical infrastructure. If you think a gold mine is gonna come on with gold at 30,000 in 2 years, like, not in the West, maybe in the maybe in Africa and other places, but not in the West, and not at scale. And Bitcoin, like, 21 million's it, right? So the price of Bitcoin goes to a million, like, there's not going to be, there may be more people mining Bitcoin, but it doesn't, they're not going to, they're just going to be more competitors for the same supply. And the algorithm's going to sort of space out the pace at which that supply hits the market. So, with the difficulty adjustment. So, I to me, Bitcoin stands to benefit. At the very least, Bitcoin stands to benefit massively from everything we just discussed. And it will serve, in my opinion, as a liquidity sink for the inflation that will come from what we're describing. And longer term, when you look at the Genius Act and stablecoins and some of these things, it I think here too, it is in the US government's interest for a much higher price of Bitcoin. Because if you want more stablecoins to buy T-bills, you need a higher price of Bitcoin at the end of the day, in my opinion. Yeah, you're going to get some people in the world buying some stable coins just because, the dollar's better than their crappy currency. But, like, that's going to cover like 2 months of deficit. Like, if you aggregate the savings of all those people after currency adjustment, like, they're going to cover, what are they, like, they're going to cover 6 months of deficit, they're going to cover 2 months, they cover a year. So what? That's like meaningless. So, in the grand scheme of things. So I think ultimately, to really get some juice to the stablecoin initiative, you need prices of Bitcoin that are way, way higher than they currently sit today. So that's how I think about the two of them.
Yeah, looking at them in parallel versus, one versus the other. And I appreciate your answer on the, let's say the effectiveness of the stablecoin idea, because that's not something that I've necessarily been able to get a straight answer on. But do you think it can be a bad thing for central banks to be hoarding gold like this?
No, because ultimately it's going to bring balance back to the system in the way that is good for the vast majority of humanity and for Americans. This the reason why the U.S. what we started off discussing, the reason why the U.S. has been so deindustrialized is ultimately the currency system. All right, you don't get to be the reserve currency with your bond as the primary reserve asset and have a factory base. It's just the rules. It's just double entry bookkeeping accounting. It's Triffin's dilemma. And so, if you want to fix that, you have to go back to some sort of neutral reserve asset. And so, central banks buying gold is essentially, they're telling you the old system's over. They've been telling us that for 11 years. And same kind of thing. 11 years ago, 10 years ago, 9 years ago, 8 years ago, people were like, "Ah, oh, look at that crazy guy in Cleveland." Well, now they're like, "He's not crazy, but gold's a bubble." Like, you're almost there. Keep going. It's a good thing. It rebalances. Basically, all of these economic theories that Western economists point to, whether it's Adam Smith, we're Adam Smith capitalists. Adam Smith assumed that deficits were settled in gold. Keynes, when you look at his early work, net settling in gold. When you look at all of these economic theories, if you settle them in debt that never gets settled, as we have done for 50 years, you can take them all and you can wad them up and you can throw them in the trash long term, because what they will result in is, massive wealth inequality, and most importantly, the United States being completely hollowed out and destroyed by what has occurred. So to me, moving to a neutral reserve asset system, having central banks do that, I think just reinforces this is where it's going. This is how we're going to get out of the debt situation, and it's going to rebalance things in the U.S. from a standpoint of, if moving away from a neutral reserve asset was really good for Wall Street and really good for Washington and really good for China and really bad for the American working class, the American middle class, and for the industrial production and output, productive output and infrastructure of the United States, then going back to gold is going to do the reverse. And if you can do the reverse, we have a shot of reducing the wealth inequality and the political instability in this country that is on a very dangerous path. And so I'm optimistic that what we're seeing central banks do with gold is not sort of, what a lot of the sort of, the debt bugs, the dollar bugs, as we'll say. I was watching Andrew Russ Sorkin on TV with Mark Cuban and Bill Maher the other day crapping on gold, right? Like those guys are, oh, it's terrible gold's going on. Listen, it's not terrible what gold's going on. You don't want to know what's not terrible, what's really terrible? If gold doesn't go up, because there's going to be a lot more people shot on the streets of Manhattan. You're going to get a lot more Mamdanis in office taking your house from you and reallocating it. Like that's what happens if gold doesn't go up. And so these guys don't get that, and that's okay. They're not historians. I'm encouraged that central banks are buying gold and the price of gold is going up. Like that is the least worst option.
Going back to your point about the idea of gold being in a bubble here, I think, I've had a couple conversations recently where it seems like people that have been in this industry or around gold for a long time, now, now that it's starting to get exciting, now that it's starting to get some momentum, they really seem like they're in a place where they want to keep what they now on paper have, gained, let's say, and they don't want to lose that. So I think that's, a protective mechanism that is built into, let's say, the average person that owns gold, which I can absolutely understand. But, the way that you and I have walked through this and laid it out, there doesn't seem to be a particular place where, actually, there's a better way to say it. Tell me what could go wrong for gold at this point. As you said, like what would be the problem when if gold wasn't reacting to this?
So, what could go wrong for gold? If the United States is able to basically put a Boris Yeltsin in charge of China and in charge of Russia and in charge of all the BRICS and basically restore the unipolar moment to sort of, where we were in 1990 or 91. And have them basically sell off their country to Western interests at, pennies on the dollar. And then we gain control of those things and we use those assets and raw material production to, sort of reinforce dollar hegemony, then gold's going down. Like
And somehow increase the appetite for US debt as well.
Yeah, well, you could do that because basically what you're going to be doing is enslaving the world by doing that. Basically, right? You will force them to take it because you'll control all the assets, and basically you will impoverish, you'll impoverish, what was it, 8 billion people on the planet? We will basically put our leaders, our Boris Yeltsin, in around the world, and those citizens will all live peacefully in poverty, as the Chinese and the Russians were in 1990, for the rest of their lives, even though they're going to have the internet to see how awesome things are in America and to talk to each other, which they didn't back then. And they're going to buy treasuries, basically, right? Instead of buying all the nice stuff they can see on the internet and all of the nice goods they're making, they are going to buy treasuries from America, which yield negative 10%, and while they send us all the labor that and all the commodities that they make. In that case, you're not going to need gold. Like that's gold's going back to whatever, $600 an ounce, $1,000 an ounce, $300, whatever the Americans say it is, right? Now, that system, that's not going to happen. That's not, there's zero chance that's going to happen. in my opinion, without a war. And oh, by the way, if there's a war between us and China and Russia, like gold's gonna be about the only thing financial asset you wanna own, right? So between here and there. So, and I think more importantly, let's look at it empirically, realistically. This was already arbitrated. This was already, adjudicated in Ukraine. We lost. NATO lost. I've been saying this for a year again. Oh, he's an idiot. He had no time. Yesterday, FT reports Trump told Zelensky, like, seek terms or else he's going to destroy you. So, like,
He's going to
as
destroy
someone
the country.
said, yeah, I don't like that. But again, I need to be a realist for my clients and for my own money. And that outcome has been very obvious for at least 2 years. If you look at the logistics of what was happening relative to, the hopium and the optimism and, tactics and all this stuff that everybody likes to talk about that's more sexy, logistics trumps tactics, full stop. And so it was just gonna be a question of sort of like, how did it play out? In the same way that, we started talking about the new currency system in World War II in like 42. Like maybe it was 43, but still, like the war went on for, well, how did we know? Well, it's simple. There's very simple math. You just calculate all of the industrial capacity of the United States and all the industrial capacity of the Soviet Union, and then you total up the capacity of Japan and Germany and Italy, and you go, this is over. It's just, how long is it going to go on? Same type of dynamic. So, I think this has already been like that proxy war was sort of okay. We want to keep the monetary system under the rules-based global order. You want a new one, let's fight it out. And it was fought out. And we're now with the rare earth situation in particular in the last couple of weeks, that's been made crystal clear. The U.S. military is done getting rare earths from China for military goods, which means, that translates that we can't go to war. We cannot go to conventional war for anything more than a few weeks with any near peer or peer powers. In that case, like our ability to fight changes to the rules-based global order is over. And there's going to be monetary changes to the rules-based global order as a result. And I think we're starting to see, I think that's what gold is starting to sniff out. So, that would probably be the biggest, the other thing that would maybe make gold go down, maybe would be some sort of, massive productivity miracle that showed up, but that didn't create massive amounts of unemployment. Which, here too, the very definition of productivity is you do more with less, right? So if you have a productivity miracle, you're going to do a lot more with a lot less, but somehow not fire a bunch of people, which would blow up the debt. It's not going to happen. So, I understand the desire to like, look, if you've got like your entire savings in it, you probably should take some off the table, right? Like there's, but I think. I think there is a lack of understanding about the degree to which the intractability of the situation in which the West has found itself and the momentousness of the moment. We are watching the end of a 100-year debt cycle. We are watching the end of a 150-year Western social democracy entitlement experiment, right? This, let's call entitlements what they are. It's a Ponzi scheme, right? At the end of the, and that's fine. It's a beneficial Ponzi scheme for a long time, but it's a Ponzi scheme. The new entrants pay money into a system that pay out the old entrants. What happens when Ponzi, well, how do Ponzi schemes blow up? They blow up when more people start taking money out than are putting money in. What does every investor on the planet know? Demographics are getting upside down relative to these Ponzi schemes. And yet everybody's too sure. And yet I see so many investors like, oh God, gold's at 4,000. I've got to get my money out now. Like the biggest Ponzi scheme in recorded history, going back 150 years, is going into reverse. And you want to take your money out of the one asset that has no counterparty risk if you hold it physically? Why? Why are you now? I think it's also really important to understand. Like, again, I'll take an extreme example. When you look at Weimar Germany, and again, I am not saying we are going Weimar Germany. I'm simply saying it's a very useful example. Dan Oliver at Mermican Capital has this great chart that I put in our work a number of times, and it shows that gold went from basically whatever, two or you know five whatever German Reichsmarks to a trillion German Reichsmarks in like 10 years. And people say, oh, you know, I just want to be levered long gold, short Reichsmarks, buy gold.
Right.
And yet, the brilliance of Dan's chart, it shows the monthly moves in German Reichsmarks in gold. And if you were levered long, you literally lost all of your money four or five times in four or five different years. You had to own gold, unlevered, and just sit tight through face-peeling volatility. And why was that face-peeling volatility? Well, it was things like the war reparations are actually going to get repaid and they're getting more moderate. And people actually sold gold to buy German Reichsmarks. Okay. As it's on its way to a trillion. Because humans are short term and they're focused, they're levered, whatever. You saw it earlier this year. Elon Musk is going to, he's going to doge. He's going to find 2 trillion in cost savings. I'm like, it didn't take like a whole lot of like deep research to go like, that's nonsense.
Mm-hmm.
Just look at the quarterly Treasury Borrowing Advisory Committee. Go, great. What are they cutting? Rates? Well, that's good for gold. Are they cutting defense? No. Are they cutting entitlements? Good luck. There's already people getting shot in the streets. They don't cut any of those three things. They ain't cutting anything.
Yeah.
And guess what? They couldn't cut anything. So, right. So we had this moment where, you know, Bitcoin and gold were under some pressure. They didn't do anything because Doge is going to save us. Same kind of, it's not as extreme as Weimar, but it's the same dynamic. They believed in the entitlement, or they believed in the war reparations. War reparations going to get paid. They literally don't have the economy to repay them. Doge is going to save us. It's going to save the field. You can't. They're not with that debt, not with what they'd have to cut. Like, it's not. So it's more around just understanding from here on out, gold vol is going to be high, right? We were down 108 on Friday. People are like, oh, it's over. Well, it's up 140 today. How you like them apples? But that's going to be the new normal. So look, if that's too volatile for you, like number one, you shouldn't be holding gold levered right now. Like, because I do think it's in nobody's interest to have a bunch of levered hedge funds get rich as gold goes from whatever to whatever its ultimate price I think is going to be. And so you need to shake those guys out. How do you shake them out? Every now and then you drop gold 3% a day. Poof, everyone's out. And it's really hard to get back in once you're out. But if you hold physical, just hold physical, sit tight, be right.
Look, one of the last things I want to go over with you is a possible, you know, liquidity problem here. You know, there's been some ideas pointed to that, let's say, interbank trust is possibly going down because of some of the, let's say, the dislocations in the silver market and especially lease rates. Do you think that this is a fair assessment? And I'll add one thing after that.
I don't know. I can see, and I have people I talk to and trust that are saying things are very tight in the silver markets. And so I think, you know, that's what the lease rates are confirming. Mm-hmm. But I don't know enough sort of how the bodies are to say, hey, it's bad for this or that. I mean, and you would assume somebody will get caught in it because that's kind of how it always works when we get these kind of moves. But I just don't know well enough to have a strong viewpoint on it.
Well, I appreciate that very, very candid answer. But let's say on the other side of this, Luke, you know, I've been seeing reports that there was, you know, $8.35 billion put back into the system through a repo operation at some point last week, as well as kind of a muted announcement from the Fed that another $491 billion has been set aside in a standing repo facility. Is this, you know, another sign of possible liquidity problems for the banks in the U.S.?
There too, I'm not sure. I was looking at that announcement, that $500 billion, and the way they phrase it looked like it was that $8.5 billion number was the number, not the 491, because it was like it's the $500 billion that is not used. I forget how they phrase it, but it's basically like a It's like double negative language almost, but it to me, to my reading of it was some repo operation of 8.5 billion up to 500 billion, and they took down 8.5 billion. Look, you can see there are signs of strains when you look at some of SOFR rates, and you look at some of the short-term money market rates. You can see bank reserves are getting down to levels that have in the last 5 years, at least, portended issues, so to speak, liquidity issues. So that would stand to reason. You've seen a couple of kind of the subprime auto type stuff. The one thing that I don't think has been, that I did get that I had, call it pinged by or some credible rumblings of last week was that I'm not seeing a lot of discussion about because it's kind of sensitive politically. But these ICE raids are, moving a lot of people out of the country. And to some extent, when those people leave, they don't take the car with them. They certainly don't take their apartment with them. And so it is starting to, on the margin, I hear, drive higher levels of vacancy rates in apartments. It's starting to drive some credit issues and sort of low-end credit with some private credit. It's hard to tell how big that is in terms of A, how many people were here, and B, how many of those people have left in response to this. But it would be one of these unintended consequences, right? Of like the old, like the old Chinese, hey, we have too many sparrows, so kill the sparrows, right? And well, it turns out the sparrows were killing the locusts and keeping the locusts from eating all the food that the people needed. And so they killed all the sparrows, and then the locusts was proliferated, and there was a famine. Same kind of thing where on the surface, I understand what the Trump administration is trying to do, which is tighten labor markets. It is hard to have wages rise for middle working classes, for your constituents, if you have wide open borders. And if the people that are here illegally now are being left, that's also, it's going to improve jobs, opportunities, and wages for, people that are here legally. And it's also there is some large illegal economy, illegal in quotes, that is now seeing population declines, potentially very significant population declines and credit losses. And we're in a highly leveraged system, so credit losses anywhere tend to magnify into credit losses everywhere, given enough credit losses in the passage of time. So, is there something going on? Maybe. I don't know yet. I've not kind of seen, for me, I'm always looking for kind of a data point where I'm like, oh God. And I've not seen sort of an oh God data point on that yet. It's more like, okay, there's something happening here, but it's not like, holy cow, Katie bar the door, things are about to get, really, really, really weird or really ugly. So it's not an answer. It's kind of an answer. It's like, I'm not seeing the, I'm seeing some smoke. I'm not seeing a lot of smoke, and so I don't see where the fire is yet, but let's watch.
Perfect. Luke, what would be, let's say, three sectors that you're watching, considering all of what we talked about today, three sectors that you're watching that would be good things to consider in order to profit from this?
I think everybody needs to have, probably, everybody needs to own physical gold. Number one, I continue to like Bitcoin. I think Bitcoin is going to do well, and I continue. I just increased my investment in a private equity deal with the investors I had been already had one with for electrical infrastructure here in the U.S. To me, there is just so much open field running, and I like things where there's years of open field running. I'm not a hugely active trader personally. I tend to look for really big imbalances and just sit and wait. And I think electrical infrastructure, industrials are, there is just so much open field running for years to come. And so those are the types of situations I like to be involved in.
Excellent. Luke, is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up here?
I would just say, I think it's important to be unlevered because I think volatility is going to be a feature of these markets. Elevated volatility is going to be a feature of these markets for some time to come, for the foreseeable future. And I think it's super important to understand the operating environment we're in, right? It's easy to get lost in the day-to-day and the price moves, especially when it's very volatile, but keep kind of recentering back to like, this is the end of a 100-year debt cycle. This is the end of a 150-year Western social democracy entitlement scheme. This is the divorce of two massive global powers, one of whom has supported the bond market and currency system of the other with their industrial base and the disinflation of that industrial base as the other one tries to reshore in only a modestly inflationary manner. And if you kind of keep those sort of North Stars in mind through the volatility, I think you're going to have a better chance of making more better decisions that you're happy with in the long term versus trying to sort of, get whipsawed by the what I think is likely to continue to be heightened volatility across a number of different markets.
Excellent. Luke, it's always a pleasure to speak with you and get to pick your brain and blow my mind. For anybody that wants to check out more of Luke's work, it's all available at fftt-llc.com. And of course, excellent Twitter follow at Luke Groman. Luke, thanks so much for your time today. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. It was great speaking with you.